So one of the really great things about kids is how curious they are. They're just full of questions, and they don't hold back from asking them. If they want to know something, they will ask. If they want to understand something, they will ask you. And we've all kind of experienced how this plays out. Sometimes I'll be FaceTiming with my nieces or nephews, and they'll ask me what I'm doing. So I'll tell them, you know, I'm making dinner. And then they'll ask me what I'm making for dinner, so I'll tell them spaghetti. And then they'll ask me that one question that we've all heard, why? We all know that that line of questioning can continue for quite some time. So after many more questions and several minutes of conversation, we've established that I like spaghetti, and also that's all I had in the pantry to make, and that I've been kind of busy and I haven't made time to go to the grocery store. So these kinds of questions can be a little exasperating if you're on the receiving end of them. But what they reveal is a desire to know and to understand. And kids will keep asking until they get a satisfactory answer. They're not content with our short answers that don't really explain what they want to figure out, whether it's why you're making spaghetti for dinner, or it's a really deep and thoughtful question about life and death and the world that only a child can come up with. So they keep asking. And Job is one of those characters in the Bible who has a lot of questions. He is trying to figure out why so many terrible things have happened to him. And so he asks God, and he talks to his friends. And we pick up Job's story today at a really crucial point, because for over 30 chapters, Job has been having a conversation with God and with his friends about why his children have died, and why he's lost all of his property and gotten sick. None of it makes any sense because Job was blameless and upright. He feared God and turned away from evil. So why did all of this awfulness befall him? Now, Job has some friends, as I mentioned, who offer their input. But I use the word friend pretty loosely here because these are the worst kind of friends to have in this situation. To be fair, for 7 days, they do sit with Job and grieve with him. But then instead of continuing to acknowledge Job's pain and affirming the tragedy and loss of his experience, they tell Job that all of this must have happened because of something he did. Clearly, Job's being punished for some wrongdoing. But Job continues to defend his integrity and his actions, claiming that their assessment isn't true, and it doesn't sufficiently answer his questions. Because Job has an understanding of the way the world works, and his experiences aren't fitting that understanding. So then, finally, God answers Job, out of a whirlwind, no less. And we can't guess what Job was hoping or expecting to hear, but I doubt that it's what he got. Because Job is answered with a bunch of God's own questions. God asks Job where he was when God laid the foundation of the earth. God asks Job who laid the cornerstones of the earth. Who can tilt the waterskins of the heavens, and who provides the prey for the ravens? And these aren't trick questions. The answers are simply that Job was not there, and Job cannot do those things. They're not really rhetorical questions either, and I don't think God's trying to chastise Job or just prove him wrong. Job had his own conception about God and the world and his own place in it. And in asking these questions in response, God's simply demonstrating who God is and who Job is. By answering in this way, God's telling Job that his understanding of God and the world and how it all works, it's not really big enough to encompass all that God has done and is doing in creation. Maybe it's impossible to understand it all because God's just that big and beyond our comprehension. But if you're anything like me, that's not a super satisfying answer. I don't love the not knowing and having to be okay with that not knowing. And I'd imagine that Job wouldn't have been thrilled with this response either. We do know that by the end of the book in chapter 42, Job is humbled and satisfied. But this answer from God in chapter 38 probably wasn't what Job was expecting or hoping to hear, because it doesn't fit with Job's understanding of who God is and who he is and how things should work. So if I were Job, I'd be kind of annoyed to be reminded of all the things that I cannot do and cannot control, especially in the midst of suffering. Because it's kind of inconvenient when we don't get the answer we want, or we get an answer that forces us to rethink everything we thought we knew or understood. Because that takes a lot of time and energy and bravery that most of us don't want to give or can't give or won't give. And it's inconvenient, to say the least, to be confronted with the reality that we don't know everything, that we're not all-powerful, that we're not in control of it all, that we're not God. Because as this passage makes very clear, only God is God. God determined the measurements of the earth. God can send forth lightnings and has put wisdom in the inward parts. We can't. We're like Job. We're people. There's a lot we can't do and a lot we don't know, and this might leave us feeling pretty insignificant and overwhelmed and powerless. And that's unsettling and uncomfortable, because for the most part, we like to have control and power and to get what we want. We want to be the most significant, the most knowledgeable. We want to be at the top of our game and to be first on the list. And that's certainly what the disciples in Mark want. James and John go so far as to ask Jesus for this explicitly. Jesus and his disciples are traveling as they did, and Jesus has literally just told them that they are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death. Then they will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit upon him and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise again. Now, as horrible and unbelievable as that would have been to hear, it also seems pretty straightforward. Jesus isn't hiding what's coming. In fact, he's telling them exactly what's going to happen. But the disciples seem to have either missed that whole conversation, or they really just didn't get it. And so two of them say to Jesus, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." Classic disciples, right? Because that feels like a weird thing to ask after Jesus has foretold his death and resurrection for the third time in as many chapters. But that's what they do. And it's easy for us to roll our eyes at James and John and their complete lack of understanding of what's to come and what it means to follow Jesus. We can shake our heads at the fact that they just don't get it, even though Jesus has told them everything more than once. But if we do that, we'll probably miss where we likely find ourselves in this story. So Jesus seems to entertain the request and responds by asking them what they want him to do. "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your glory," they say. Well, again, they've clearly not been paying attention, and they're definitely not anticipating what's to come, when Jesus will be on the cross with a criminal on either side of him. So James and John and the rest of the disciples, who then get angry when they realize that those two beat them to asking this question, they have this notion of what it means to have glory, and it couldn't be farther from what Jesus was trying to teach them. But Jesus doesn't get mad at the disciples for asking the question. He just answers them. Again, Jesus explains to them that that's not how this works. They really missed the point. Their desire for honor and glory and their understanding of greatness and power isn't what they should be working towards. They need to completely shift their thinking. And if this sounds familiar to you, it's because just a couple weeks ago, we heard this story play out in a slightly different way in Mark 9. And Caitlin talked about how Jesus redefined greatness as the disciples argued with one another about who was the greatest. Just last week, we heard about how our notions of wealth and success aren't necessarily in line with what Jesus taught about entering the kingdom of God. So what do we do when God answers us in ways that require us to rethink what it means to follow Jesus? What do we do when we're confronted with what we don't know and what we don't have power and control over? What do we do when we face the inconvenience, the disappointment, the tragedy of an answer that turns all of our understandings upside down? Well, the good news is that we have one answer for these questions as well. Jesus tells all the disciples that the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. And so we are called to serve. We don't have it all figured out perfectly. There's a lot we don't know, and we still have a lot of questions. We don't have all the answers for what it means to follow Jesus and what it means to serve others. We don't have all the power and all the control over all the things. But the prophet Micah reminds us that God has told us what is good. The Lord requires us to seek justice and love, kindness, and walk humbly with God. And we can do all of those things every single day. So when hurricanes devastate communities in this corner of the country, we immediately gather to figure out what we can do and when we can do it and how we can most effectively use our resources to assist our neighbors. Or at youth group, we can give groups of teenagers $10 each and invite them to go do something kind and good in the community. And they'll come up with creative and thoughtful and inspiring acts of service. Together, we can strive not for glory or power or control, but to faithfully serve others. We can continue to ask questions, and we can try to be open to experience however God might answer us, as inconvenient as that answer might be. Amen.